Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Well-behaved women seldom make history. You've probably heard that phrase. It's a rallying cry for many women who seek to challenge the odds at home, at work, or in society. And it was originally written back in 1976 by historian Laurel Thatcher Ulrich. She's the groundbreaking Harvard historian who won a Pulitzer Prize and a Bancroft Prize for A Midwife's Tale. And she's out now with a new book on women in polygamist marriages in the early Mormon church. The book is called A House Full of Females, Plural Marriage and Women's Rights in Early Mormonism. And Ulrich paints a beautiful picture of the everyday lives of women in the church. And she argues that 19th century Mormon polygamy may have actually helped drive part of the early women's rights movements. Ulrich is a MacArthur Fellow and past president of the American Historical Association and the Mormon History Association, and she joins us now in the studio. Professor Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, welcome to Radio Boston.
I'm delighted to be here.
It's an absolute delight to have you. First of all, I have to say, help me untie the confused knot in my mind, because when I first hear Mormon polygamy, the very next thought I can tell you is not, oh, help drives feminism.
No, no.
What's going on here?
Well, it's a terrific puzzle, which is why it made a good topic for a book. I mean, we all like contradictions. And the notion of Mormon women as somehow, you know, shackled to an old-fashioned patriarchy. And yet the interesting thing is women in early Utah, which was the center of Mormon migration in the middle of the 19th century, were actually the first in the nation to cast a vote. Wyoming passed a women's suffrage bill, but Utah had an election first. And there were a lot more people, a lot more voters in Utah, including a lot more women. And they voted in 1870. They also participated in a constitutional convention to write a new constitution as Utah was trying to become a state. And argued they were first in the world to do that.
Okay, so let me ask you, we'll get to the polygamy part, of course,
yeah,
in just a moment here.
Yeah.
But regarding women's suffrage in Utah, so was it church teaching? Was it church elders? Who decided that, yes, far before the nation as a whole gave them the right to vote, that they should do so in Utah?
Well, it's a really interesting story. It's kind of a political story. We know that the women's suffrage movement began to take off in 1869, when Congress was giving African Americans, males, the right to vote, and women said, well, let's give women the right to vote. And Congress declined to do that. And so there was a lot of press coverage. And somebody in the New York Times said, oh, I know who we should give the right to vote. We should give those polygamous women in Utah, and then they can get rid of this terrible system. Well, the polygamist women in Utah thought that was a terrific idea. They asked the territorial legislature. The territorial legislature passed women's suffrage as partly a response to a draconian anti-polygamy legislation that had passed the U.S. House.
Right.
So it was a political demonstration, but it also laid the groundwork for longstanding participation in the national women's rights
movement. Oh, that is so fascinating. So polygamous women were given women's suffrage early in part as a response to anti-polygamy legislation.
Exactly.
Which they opposed.
Yes. So they stood up, defended polygamy, and demanded their rights as citizens. And it just confused everybody and still confuses people today.
I'm raising my hand. I'll be perfectly honest. I still do feel a little confused.
Yes.
So give us a little bit of the background here then. I mean, how, when, and why, for people who don't know the history of the church, did polygamy become part of Mormonism in the 19th century, of course.
It was in the 19th century. Yeah. Well, it became part of Mormonism in the 1840s in a utopian LDS community on the Mississippi River. Nauvoo, Illinois, is where the Latter-day Saints gathered. The church was founded in 1830, so it's very new, very new. And they're building a community that they believe will welcome Jesus when he comes again. Mm-hmm. This was a period in the 19th century when everyone imagined, you know, that millennial moment. And the practice began in secret and rather slowly around the first of the Mormon prophets, Joseph Smith, mm-hmm. and then spread to a few of his followers. But when he was murdered in 1844 and Brigham Young became the successor, he embraced this new teaching, and there was a huge expansion of what they called plural marriage at that point. And they felt it was biblical.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, so what was their justification?
Yeah, their justification is this is the blessing of Abraham. Going back to the Old Testament, God gave Abraham Sarah, and Sarah gave Abraham Hagar. And therefore, polygamy was at the very beginning. Hmm. Unfortunately, Joseph Smith didn't sort of explain why this made sense in the 19th century. He just said, God told me to do it.
Right.
And the women who were married to Joseph Smith, we don't know what kind of relationship that was. They refer to it as sealing. So women who were spiritually sealed to Joseph Smith became some of the most important female leaders in the church. And some of those women were on the platform in 1870 when they were defending polygamy and asking for the vote.
Well, of course, as you hinted earlier, I mean, from the start, polygamy was a highly controversial practice.
Highly controversial.
And Mormonism was, that's one of the reasons why external viewers of Mormonism often referred to the religion as a cult. But let me ask you, I mean, let's get back to the heart of what your book is about.
Yes.
And that is that you uncover a history here where plural marriage or polygamy allowed, you say, women to do things and to advance women's rights in a way that they otherwise might not have?
Well, it's a really, really complicated story. Not everybody loved it, but those who embraced it and attempted to create really a communal society where everybody mattered and everyone belonged, became very adept at working collaboratively in women's organizations for collaborative economic activities. Women could own property. There were many ways in this society where they had rights that were not available to monogamous women in other parts of the country. So essentially no-fault divorce. And it's interesting, there are just some fascinating stories of women who left an abusive marriage, perhaps an alcoholic husband, to become Latter-day Saints and then profess themselves very happy to be in a household with other women. Mm. So it's not just about relationships with men. It's relationships among women themselves in cooperative housekeeping and child raising and charitable activities of many kinds.
Now, your book is based on years of scholarship drawing from, obviously, the diaries and letters, meeting notes written at the time. What are some of the things, I mean, what do the women themselves have to say from these diaries and letters?
Well, they, wonderful statement from a Boston woman, actually, a school teacher in Boston who became the third plural wife of Brigham Young. And she said, I want the liberty to choose my own husband. It's a very interesting concept. What she meant was, I want to be married to Brigham Young. He's already married. He's happy to add me to his household, and I will do that. Other women found themselves dismayed, particularly first wives, when their husband felt he was had a kind of responsibility to reach out and make sure every woman in the community had a family, had a household, and they would complain. Some of them left, which they had the right to do. So there are a range of feelings about it, but I think the central core is they believed this was to transcend selfishness and to create a community where every woman had a home and the right to have a family.
Okay. So, Professor Ulrich, I have to say, I'm still not quite seeing the connection between these rights that you just laid out and the communal strength that you were talking about.
Yes.
That women may have felt in these plural marriages. And how that translates to political power or the women's movement writ larger. Because in my mind, I'm still seeing these polygamous marriages as unions that are brought that are approved of by a patriarchal church, right?
Uh-huh.
And so how does that then break out and influence women's rights writ large?
Well, it's a patriarchal and matriarchal church. So the highest order of priesthood in the church is to be sealed in an eternal marriage. And so women also have, they heal, bless the sick. They have ritual blessings for women in childbirth. They develop, for example, there's a council of health that oversees health care in the territory. They're notoriously suspicious of physicians, particularly those that use, you know, opium and mercurial remedies that are highly dangerous at the time, bloodletting, those kinds of things. So they believe in gentle medicine, herbal medicine, and that's very female-centered. And they kind of organize, and they're part of the kind of oversight of health care in the community. They're also involved in caring for immigrants and doing cooperative work to raise money. One of the fascinating little details about their political activity in 1870 is that a group of them had built a hall, a women's hall, where they met together on the upper floor, and on the lower floor, they sold things that they had made cooperatively. They raised the money to build the building, didn't want anyone's help to do it. So it's, you know, it's a commonplace that women's political activity often grows out of concern for other people. So we think of the early petitioning activities for the anti-slavery movement,
right,
or petitions against the removal of Cherokees. And the Latter-day Saint movement began in the same period.
Uh-huh.
And women were already involved in these kinds of activities, petitioning for redress of having lost their land in Missouri.
Oh, interesting.
When they were mobbed and sent out of there.
But I have to ask you, correct me if I'm wrong, but the church was forced to disavow polygamy when,
yes,
Utah wanted statehood, right?
Exactly. So they had six different petitions for statehood beginning in the 1840s and going to the 1890s. And it was a strong fight. So when the Supreme Court ultimately ruled that the anti-polygamy legislation was constitutional, then they backed down and publicly abandoned polygamy. It took a while to make that happen, and received statehood in 1896, long after they had had the population and the infrastructure to justify.
Right. And of course, we should note that there are still some practitioners who, they're not formally sanctioned by the church, of course.
No,
outside the church.
They're a small number.
Yeah. Professor Ulrich, you yourself are a Mormon.
Yes.
I'm just curious what it meant to you and your understanding of your own faith to research this history.
Oh, it was an amazing experience because it was going back to things that I thought I knew. And, you know, the things you get as stories from your grandparents are not the same thing as being a professional historian and diving into the archives. So I was surprised about lots of things.
Yeah.
That, for example, it was a very charismatic faith. I mean, today Mormons are kind of well-behaved.
There's that phrase again.
I mean,
again.
maybe a little boring. I mean, it depends. But in the 19th century, there was a lot of speaking in tongues, a lot of kind of public ritual healing, dancing,
yeah.
Dancing in the temple with the fiddle. Very expressive, very emotionally demonstrative group of people.
Well, we've just got about a minute and a half left. And
okay.
Before we run out of time, I really want to ask you one more thing.
Okay.
Because we started the conversation when I was quoting what is possibly your most famous written sentence ever.
Yes.
Well-behaved women seldom make history.
Yeah.
You wrote that, what, in 1976?
Yes.
And it was about Puritans, right?
It was about Puritan funeral sermons, for heaven's sake.
And people, I mean, it's like on bumper stickers now.
Oh, it's everywhere.
People take that as a line of that you were writing in support of disruptive behavior, but that's not what it was about, right?
No, originally it was saying, hey, let's pay attention to the people who don't make trouble and let's learn about them. But of course, I've totally embraced all the meanings because it's so much fun. It's the ambiguity,
yeah.
Really. And I think what's really wonderful is when someone who looks like, you know, goody two-shoes stands up and speaks up for herself, you know, people really listen because it's so surprising.
Do you consider yourself well-behaved?
Oh, of course not.
Thank goodness, I have
okay.
to say. Well, Laurel Thatcher Ulrich is a professor of history at Harvard University. Her new book is A House Full of Females, Plural Marriage and Women's Rights in Early Mormonism, 1835 to 1870. She's the winner of the Pulitzer Prize, the Bancroft Prize. She's also a MacArthur Fellow. She's really a giant in the world of American history. Professor Ulrich, it has been such an honor to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.